This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You can find more Joycasts and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
Hi, this is Dr. Pamela Stevenson-Connolly, and you're listening to Hide and Seek, the only program about sex, sexuality and self on Australia's only gay and lesbian radio station, Joy 94.9.
You certainly are. Dean Beck with you tonight as the boys head to Sydney to hopefully collect my award. We are joined by Dr. Beng from Paran Market Clinic, and I am so pleased that you are here. Welcome. That is my pleasure. Let me get you on the right microphone. That's better. Beng, you went to the ASHAM conference recently. Is this this is the big HIV/AIDS sexual health conference?
Yes, it's the annual.
Yeah, and conference. It was in Darwin this year.
That's correct.
Is that something that your average GP goes along to normally?
No, generally not. It's mainly
I didn't think so.
GPs who go to, who've got interest in HIV or sexual health, to go to it.
Yeah, but not even all of them go to it.
A lot of the GPs would go to it.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so, all right, what did you learn, firstly?
I followed along the theme of a lot of the rapid testing because of my interest in it. So there were some interesting papers presented about rapid testing and what's happening, you know, in other states and some stuff about Pronto. So there's lots of little things to learn and think about.
You were at Paran Market Clinic the first to adopt rapid testing in this state.
Yes.
For the public. You've been doing it since May, is that right?
Since March, actually.
March, okay. Yeah. So in that time, how many have you performed?
Between March and now, I had a quick look. It's there's been over 400 tests done. Can't tell you the exact number, but 400 something.
Okay. So from that,
yep,
you would have a fair understanding of a couple of things. One, whether you're getting any false readings,
mm-hmm,
either way.
Yep.
And two, how worthwhile it is, I guess, from a practitioner's perspective.
Yeah.
What do you reckon?
We collected the information for the first 300 and we did a poster for the ASHAM conference. So out of the first 300 tests we did, I think about 220 were in MSM, gay men.
Mm-hmm.
And of those tests, there were 9 positive results, which is actually quite high as a percentage of testing done.
That's about, what, 5?
Over 4%.
4%.
Yeah, just
4,
over 4%.
Yeah.
So it's quite high. We had one false positive test in the 300. So we're actually overall quite satisfied. One, that the false positive rate is quite low.
Was that in the antigen or the antibody window?
False positive was in the antibody.
Really?
Yep.
Wow.
Which it does happen. It is reported. But 1 in 300 is quite low. And I've spoken to Darren Russell from...
Because that's supposed to be the window that is the least in false positives, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. But yeah, we didn't have any antigen positive results whatsoever.
Right.
All the results were antibody results at all.
So from that, you can conclude a few things, like whether those patients might have been living with HIV for quite some time.
Yes.
Because they already have the antibodies, firstly. Secondly, they haven't presented to you because of an illness.
That's correct.
They're there because they're just there to get a test.
Yes.
So what do you conclude from that?
I think, judging on the first few hundred we did, I think there is some evidence that I think people who might be at higher risk might be coming in for testing. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, we certainly had a few people who came in for several tests in that six-month period, and some of which became HIV positive. So people who are putting themselves at more risk are probably coming in more often to be tested because of the rapid test.
Prior to you adopting this new technology, would that type of client have come in regularly to get tested anyway, for the same reasons?
Probably not as regularly.
Okay.
Because I was seeing some people who are coming every month or two, and that's very unusual. Most people would come, you know, 3 months would be a short period for
mm-hmm.
them.
Mm-hmm.
And there are certainly a number of people who are coming in very keen and asking for the rapid test, you know, but because by the end we're just offering it quite widely to anyone who was interested. But there certainly were a number who were coming in quite keen to have the test.
You aren't allowed to mention price on this radio station, but okay. I'm interested in finding out whether there was a cost involved for the individual, or did the clinic absorb the technology?
There was a cost involved, mm-hmm. because unfortunately the cost is too high for us to just absorb.
Yep, sure.
And I think that's one of the deterrents. It was an extra cost to have it done. So if someone wasn't that fussed about getting results straight away, they probably didn't want to pay the extra for it. And the other sort of barrier was just a time component. And if doctors are busy and it's part of a big consult, they might not have time to actually do the rapid test as well. Because they're having to do.
They won't have time to do the rapid test.
I know, it sounds odd, doesn't it? But, you know, because the rapid test, the doctor has to, should do it themselves, and then they have to do the 20 minutes and call the patient back in or sit with them and stuff. Whereas if they're having a normal blood test, we often will give them a blood test form and they go outside and the pathology person will do it all.
During that time, and this is about clinical practice more than it is about the patient, but do you try and work it so that you can sort of rotate your patients so that whilst you're waiting your 20 minutes, you can see another one? Or is it not as easy as that?
Well, we're doing it in lots of different ways. Yeah. And I think if someone's pretty much just coming for a rapid test and there's nothing else to discuss, then we would ask them to take a seat and we'll see the next patient and give them the result after we've seen that patient. But if there's things happening, then we'll keep them in the room and just talk about those things while we're waiting for the result. So it's like there's a bit of variety in how we do it.
Now, a positive test with a rapid test simply means another blood test, does it not?
Yes.
At first.
Yes, that's right. So, I mean, we're used to it now. So rapid test gives you a reactive result. And whilst the reactive result is likely to be positive, there are the false positives. So we talk about all that when we're talking to a patient. And in the first 300, we took blood from everyone anyway, so it didn't really matter. But now we're not taking blood from everyone anymore. So if someone hasn't had a full blood test, then they're due to have one once they had a reactive test.
And why did you do that double testing at the initial stages?
Because we were the first to use it, and one of the conditions was about liaising with a laboratory about using the test. So we spoke to our laboratory, and they said they were comfortable supervising us if we did parallel testing. So mm-hmm. we said we'd do it for a few hundred, but once we reached about 300, 350, we had to talk to them, and now they're happy for us to drop that requirement.
Okay. So from a patient's perspective, what's the feedback been?
Generally, it's been really good. I think people who've opted to have the rapid test are happy to get the result fairly quickly. You know, they get anxious waiting, but it's less anxious than waiting several days for the result.
Yeah, or a week or so,
Yeah, exactly. And for a lot of them, it means it also saves them a second visit, because for patients who are fairly straightforward, if they've had a HIV result, then there's not necessarily a need to come back for their results.
Beng, as you well know, this technology has been available around the world for almost a decade internationally.
Yes.
And they have evolved into home testing, mail order testing, indeed. Give me your thoughts on that. And is it inappropriate for our society at this point in time, purely because we haven't gone through that education process? Well, tell me what you think.
I think, you know, we are way behind the rest of the world in the rapid testing. But because we're only still coming to terms with the rapid testing, I think we need to quickly catch up with the rest of the world. So I think that there's the rapid oral test, and we're actually going to be a site for one of the Sydney studies that's happening at the moment. So we can just do an oral swap for the test. And that's the same test that they're doing for home testing in the US. And I think they're going to trial home testing here too. And I think hopefully within 2 or 3 years, we will catch up. Mm. And I don't think it's inappropriate to do home testing, as long as they're good guidelines around it and there's good support systems put in place and all that. And I don't think there's any problem with home testing.
One of the arguments against it is that if you've got, it's a Saturday night, you've got five guys coming over, you're having an orgy, you swab all their mouths, everyone comes through without a positive test, bang, it's on.
Yes.
Go nuts. Literally.
Yep. And is there concern that the fact that maybe, you know, a negative test does not fully mean negative in terms of someone might be seroconverting or just contracted it? I think that's true, and that's one of the things that's been talked about. I think what's interesting in that, in our study, we actually surveyed a lot of patients who were having the test done, and certainly no one expressed much of an intent to reduce condom use just because they had rapid testing. So I'm not sure if it changes behaviour that much. Mm. But also, I think if you look on the other side...
But here's the thing, we don't know that much about the technology. We're only being taught it now.
Yes.
So I wonder if we would be more free with our practices once we become familiar with the technology.
Yes, I think it's probably true. Mm. But I think we need to educate everyone about it. But on the other hand, I suppose that's a better situation than people meeting up and just asking each other if they've had a HIV test and what the result was. At least it covers them a bit better than that. So you can look at it both ways,
sure.
Really.
Yeah. I heard a radio interview in the US on a station by and for black Americans. Mm-hmm. And they had a sexual health GP type person like yourself, yep. A woman, who was on talking about home HIV testing, and she was all for it. She said, you know, ring up your doctor and order a 5-pack, and, you know, she was going for it. But look, the scenario in the US, particularly amongst the black American community, is very different to our own.
Yes, I agree.
I read recently, also in the US, that particularly amongst men who have sex with men, the ratio to which seroconversion happens within partnerships is up to 60%. Here it's believed to be around 30%.
Yes.
In the US, it's double that.
That's
very
high.
It's extraordinary.
Did you know what's driving it, or was there any comment on that?
Well, I can give you my own opinion, and it's got something to do with right-wing American Christian values, but
right.
Because abstinence will fix everything. let's move on. Bing, the perhaps more interesting information that came out of the conference in Darwin was that not only are we seeing an increase in HIV diagnosis in this country, mm-hmm. across the board, some 10%. In New South Wales, there was an extraordinary jump, up to some 33%.
Yes.
It's scary that rapid testing is not flushing out these undiagnosed cases yet, because we haven't had it that long.
No, and it's not fully used yet. It's only in New South Wales. I think it's still largely only used in sexual health clinics and trials. I actually don't think it's spread out to the private practice arena much in New South Wales.
And it's not here that much in private practice either.
No, that's right. It's still very limited at the moment. It is really worrying. I think you said 33% is a very high jump. And I think it's something we have to watch, because I think HIV seroconversion, there's a lag time between that and people's behaviour change and what people do sexually and condom use and all that.
And a lot of that's got to do with mental health as well.
Absolutely. Mm. Yeah, yeah. And just general attitudes. I think, you know, the reality is that not many people would use condoms all the time nowadays. That's a reality. You know, people make judgment calls, and, you know, it's just a whole grey area of how you make that judgment call. And I think maybe we need to address those issues. And while some people might be happy using condoms, so the people who are not using condoms, maybe we need to have a frank discussion about what a reasonable way of assessing your risk is.
And those risk assessments are only reinforced and supported by technology like rapid testing technology like pre-exposure prophylaxis.
That's right.
It's only when you have the full suite of artillery available to you that you can you make the ultimate judgment call on all of these other variables.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah.
And I also think that because we don't talk about it very openly, it leads to a lot of people having misconceptions and making those judgments themselves with probably not enough knowledge.
Yeah.
Whereas I think if we actually talk about it more frankly, at least people can make, you know, people are going to make their own choices, but at least it's going to be a bit more informed.
One of the largest sectors of new diagnoses, as far as increase is concerned, is that sort of 29 and under age group. That,
yes.
If you like, the group not affected by the dying age of AIDS,
yep.
from 30 years ago, 20
yes.
years ago. How do we get a message through to this sector who've never grown up with this sort of threat?
Yeah, I think that that wasn't a surprising thing, because I think clinicians have started seeing that, and we all talk about how the fact that the, you know, 20 somethings have had no direct experience with HIV, mm-hmm. there's less of a fear for it. And I think I'm the wrong person to ask, because you need to ask a 20-something-year-old what we should be doing.
I get that. And look, it's one of those questions that the sector worldwide is trying to address.
Yeah.
However, then there's the other group,
Yep.
That still remain the most, the largest sector of new diagnosis, and that is people in my age group that are 35 and above.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's, I don't think that's changed a lot. You know, it's so complex, the whole HIV thing, isn't it? You know, condom use is probably still the most effective way of preventing it. But, you know, people, you know, there's people have sex, people aren't always careful all the time, people are affected by alcohol or drugs. So there are lots of factors that affect all that.
We are with Beng, who is a doctor at Paran Market Clinic. Perhaps you've got a question for him. We'd love to hear from you. You can send in your thoughts to us. We'd like to know what is on your mind.
This is the fabulous Adam Richard. You're tuned to Hide and Seek. Is that how they say it in the bit? Hide and Seek. I think it's a show about fisting, I'm not sure. Anyway, Joy 94.9. I'll never play that one, that's rude.
Haven't you missed me? Dean with you tonight, The Apprentice and The Wallbanger in Sydney. Now, my guest is Dr. Beng from Paran Market Clinic. And Beng, we've been talking about rapid testing and HIV and the increasing rates of HIV, but all STIs are up, particularly amongst gay men. They are off the radar.
Yeah, I think I was looking at recent syphilis reporting even in Victoria, and it's actually quite, it's quite high. I think it's as high as it's ever been, to be honest. It's a few hundred a year.
And gonorrhea now, if you go to a clinic, I don't know whether you're doing this, but I know that Melbourne Sexual Health is issuing a double dose of whatever the medication is, as well as the tablets as a backup.
Yeah,
it's because of this sort of increasing resistance to antibiotics.
Yeah, we've increased the antibiotic dose for a few months now due to resistance in gonorrhea. So
it's quite a concern, though, because that's in my lifetime. This has happened, you know, in the last few years, the last few months.
Well, it's true. Well, maybe that's the thing. Maybe we are forgetting about the other STIs, and because we've been focusing so much on HIV, and the fact that when you have sex, there is a risk for everything else as well, and maybe that message is getting a bit lost.
And the lovely synergy to which these diseases work together.
That's correct, yeah, because if you've got an STI, you've got higher risk of HIV transmission as well, so...
Which brings me to the increase in hepatitis C amongst men who have sex with men, particularly HIV-positive men. But I was reading an article in a UK magazine recently where the head of, let's say, their equivalent of VAC, I think it starts with G, anyway, that does all their sexual health messaging, that organisation's head said, mark my words, hepatitis C is the next HIV, give it a decade, it will be rife within the community.
Really? I didn't hear that. That's interesting.
I have it here. Hang on, I'll find it for you right now. But it's quite a concern. And over there, it's not just amongst positive men, it's amongst positive and negative men.
Right, right. So it's spread out a bit further, whereas here we're seeing it more in positive men at the moment.
Because there seems to be some sort of synergy.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, it's a big worry. And I guess the other thing that I've been reading out of the UK is quite a lot about the use of crystal meth with sex parties and injecting drug use amongst men, slamming parties, as they refer it to. Okay. It's been sensationalised to a point in the US, but for us to deny that it happens here would be to bury our heads in the sand.
I totally agree. I think, you know, I think crystal use is still a significant problem in our community. And I think it's something that's very hard to address, because there are people who think that it's all right to use it occasionally, but, you know, where do you draw the line? And I think there aren't a lot of crystal use programs for gay men. And I'm on the Ministerial Advisory Committee for Gay and Lesbian GLBTI Health, and that's one of my issues that I'm actually really keen to push forward. It's about programs for crystal use in gay men, especially in crystal use and sex scene. I think that's a very sort of specific scene that no one's sort of targeting, you know, very well at the moment. And I think that's really important. At our clinic, it's hard to tell, but we've been talking about it, and I think we're about to just do a bit of an audit to look at new HIV transmissions and how much of it might be associated with crystal use, because...
How do you go about that?
Well, we're still looking at how we can go about it. What we might do is actually
From an ethical point of view or a practical point of view?
Both. We can do it practically, but we're sort of a bit aware of the ethics as well. But what we might do is look at new HIV diagnoses from the lab, which are de-identified in terms of names, but they'll have the doctor that ordered on that. And we might get the doctor to actually fill in the forms about the patient's details and whether crystal use was an issue. So we're sort of looking into that a bit more.
What you're suggesting is, in practical terms, you can quite easily go through your records and look at someone's history and see if they have identified as being a drug user previously.
Yes.
And all of a sudden they get a seroconversion or a diagnosis of HIV positive.
Yeah.
You can bang the two together and say, well, there we go.
But is it
the ethics around that you're concerned about? Or?
There is an ethics. I don't think, you know, we're very careful with what we do, and we don't think we'd like patients to feel that there are other doctors looking through their files for information. I mean, if it's a doctor that they've seen that's looking after them, that's different. So we'll rather the patient's doctor actually did that information finding. And also, it might not actually be in their file I know that some doctors are a bit reluctant to record things like drug use in patients' histories, because it's then in their history if anyone ever asks for it. So,
really?
Yeah. Well, it's really complicated because, you know, from a medical point of view, it's good to have a full history there.
Hang on, bing. Why is it complicated? You guys are bound by the utmost in confidentiality.
Right.
And
yes,
would go to a doctor with the expectation that that will be honoured to the extreme.
Yes.
And I would necessarily feel it essential to be as honest with you as I possibly could be about my situation, whatever it was.
Yes.
What you're saying is I should be hesitant.
No, not that. But what happens is that if you go for health insurance, disability insurance, if there's a work cover claim, there are lots of situations now where companies are requesting complete files. Generally refuse it because we think it's generally unethical.
Sure.
But there have been times where basically someone's ability to get insurance is dependent on that.
Yeah.
And we've had to negotiate to see what we can release and what we can't release. So it's really unethical, all that. And so it's only situations like that. The clinic obviously would not surrender that information easily or voluntarily. It would be very loath to. But it is on the file. So if you ever go for an insurance company that insists on having your whole file, it is in your file.
Please note. They're a third party that have, I guess they're forking out money potentially.
But they are third parties. We argue with them all the time because they claim that by releasing it to them, it's confidential, but it's clearly not.
Confidential, but will impact the outcome of their results.
That's right, exactly.
How bizarre.
Yeah, but only in that setting. And I know the doctors at the clinic, some would record and some wouldn't record. So we probably ask for more information that the doctor actually follows up with the patient to ask those questions.
Is there a software package that can blind capture data that you enter into your patient's records that is non-identifiable? So basically you're taking a dual copy, one for their file, and the other for this data capture that doesn't actually capture any identifying factors.
No, there's no easy way of doing it.
Okay.
Yeah, you mean on each a specific patient file?
Yeah, everyone walks in, you get this sort of dual stream, one that goes on file and the other that just collates into some sort of data bank.
Right.
There you go. I think we've just made the next $1 million each.
Yeah.
I think we might get onto that. What is our take-home message from our conversation tonight as far as you're concerned, Bing?
I think we should be encouraging more rapid testing, exploring home testing, be open to ideas, not be so fixed in the ways we do testing and give results and all that. And I think we need to encourage more frank conversation with community, with gay men about how they have sex in all those situations, and you know, talk about what actually happens and talk about non-condom use, because that's the reality.
Mm-hmm. And PrEP?
PrEP, I think you're aware there is a study that's
in the new year.
In the new year, and we're part of that. I think PrEP is useful. There are a lot of questions about PrEP, about how you roll it out and what you tell patients. Like, do you tell someone you take this pill and you'll never get it? Or, you know, how you actually do all that. But I think it's worth exploring. And in the US, they're doing it a bit more. I think the crunch for PrEP at the end of the day in Australia would be costs, about who's going to bear the cost for PrEP, really.
We'd really like to see those who are positive on medication and adhering to it more widely, because it's only about a third.
Yep. I should think we should be treating much earlier for all the other reasons about, you know, controlling the virus. I think even people with higher T cells should consider having treatment if they're open to the idea. I think that's a conversation we really need to be having.
With the aim of at point of diagnosis, would that be your ultimate objective?
I've got no objection to that. I think most patients would find it too much of a shock to do it at point of diagnosis. Mm. But there's no reason why soon after, if someone's happy with the idea, we couldn't do it.
Bang, always a delight to speak with you. Thank you so much for your time tonight on Hide and Seek. Really do appreciate it. Good stuff.
You're most welcome.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.